Candace Michelle, and welcome to another Our Community. Homelessness in our country seems to be on the rise, and the faces of the homeless now include families sleeping in their cars and storage containers. The recent fires here in Santa Rosa and now in Ventura County are adding thousands of new faces to the growing homeless population. And the issue takes on an added poignancy during the holidays, a time normally spent decorating our homes and getting together with friends and family in celebration. Most of us feel compassion for these less fortunate and would like to help somehow. A select few of us have a passion for this issue and are constantly working to make things better for those affected. My guest today is one such person, and is a man deeply admired as one who walks his talk. Father Bernie Lindley. Welcome to the show, Father Bernie.
Well, thank you, Candace.
It's really nice to have you here. I've been wanting to have you come on the show for a long time. It finally just all fell into place.
Well, I appreciate being invited.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about you. Who the heck are you? Kind of thing.
So, you know, you were talking about how your listeners might want to know some basic things like where I was born. Do you know that I was born in a place called Crescent City, California?
No way.
It's true. They used to have a hospital down on the beach. It was some pretty premium real estate.
Yeah.
It was the Seaside Hospital, and I was born there in 1967.
Unbelievable.
Yep. And then my daughters were both born in Crescent City also, but they were born in the new hospital that's only 25 years old.
So you're really kind of a native kind of guy here.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow. So what was it like growing up in Crescent City?
Oh, well, I didn't grow up in Crescent City. Oh. Brookings doesn't have a hospital.
So what?
A lot of Brookings folks get born in Crescent City, it turns out.
So then you grew up here in Brookings.
Yeah,
well, tell me about growing up in Brookings.
Yeah, so I grew up the north bank of the Chetco River, a couple of miles up.
Wow.
And, you know, all kinds of things are different than they used to be.
Of course.
Didn't have city water. We had to get our water from a spring, and it came down and was fed into a reservoir into the house.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
But we had indoor plumbing, though.
That's good. That's very good. Was there just you, or did you have brothers and sisters?
Oh, no, I have a sister. Her name's Kim. She lives near where we grew up.
Okay. So when you were growing up, this town must have been much smaller.
You know, it was. A lot's changed. Of course, we didn't have Fred Meyer then, so that was different.
Right.
But, you know, the changes are so gradual that it just sort of seems the same, really. Traffic's worse, of course.
Yeah.
A lot more stoplights than there was before.
Yeah, but come on, how many do we actually have?
I don't know, but we only had one back then. You didn't have to dial all those numbers in order to make a phone call. You just dialed a 9 for your prefix or whatever.
No kidding.
Yeah, so you only had to know 5 numbers. And the first one was always the same. The 9 was always the same. So
4, 6, 9.
All you had to know was 4 digits in order to be able to make a phone call.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, that must be kind of fun, though, because you'd know everybody if it was a fairly small town.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of people I went to high school with. Mm-hmm. I went to high school with the chief of police, Chris Wallace.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Went to high school with a couple of different people that work for the sheriff's department, my friend mm-hmm. John Inslee and I,
mm-hmm.
wearing Boy Scouts, well, Cub Scouts together. His mother was our den leader back in the day. Yeah. So that's pretty fun.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's interesting to have those kinds of roots in the community because you see this community, I would think, very differently with that kind of a perspective.
Yeah, sure. We there's a lot of pining away for what used to be, but then there's also an understanding for really where we've come from and who we are. You know, at the core of our being as a community is a fishing and logging community, you know, a timber industry community.
Right.
And the commercial fishing, we've been saying for the last 40 years that it's going away, but it never did. Mm-hmm. So I continue to do that. I fished for my father back in the, and when I was in high school during the summers.
Really?
And so we had a boat called the Panda back then. And I worked on the boat with him. And interestingly enough, the guy that was the other crewman on the boat was my godfather. His name was Gene. And anyway, but you know how things go. It turns out that I did his memorial service when he passed away. So things kind of go full circle for me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, and I think that if you stay in the town that you were born in, they kind of have to go full circle.
You have opportunities for that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
Yep. He didn't really brag about being my godfather or anything, but my godmother appreciates
brag?
Me, though.
I'd brag on that.
Well,
that's
my godmother might. Her name's Shannon. I love her very much.
Hi, Shannon.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. So what was it like being out on a boat?
So, you know, when I was probably 15, I guess, well, it was 1982, I know that. When I started fishing, I wasn't real worried or concerned or anything because, you know, it was the family business. My grandfather had been fishing and my dad, of course, and it just seemed like a natural progression. And but I didn't figure I wanted to make that into a career or anything. So my wife, well, one thing too that you might not know is that my wife and I met when I was only 12 years old.
No.
Yeah, that's right. And
you were like sweethearts?
We still are.
Oh, wow.
But
you know how rare that is, right?
Well, we didn't start going steady till I was 13, though.
Oh, my word. You've been going steady with her since you were 13.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that's kind of fun. So we went to college. We went to the same college. And
where'd you go to college?
In Salem, Oregon, there's a place called Willamette University.
Okay.
And so we went there. And she went to community college in Crescent City for a year beforehand. So, 'cause she's a year older than I am. I dated an older woman.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Scandalous.
Yep.
Especially in those days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, she went and did a year down there at the whatever that college is called.
Redwood?
Yeah. We should know.
Yeah, we should know. Sorry.
But anyway, she was that year that she spent there was very beneficial for her. Mm-hmm. So when we went to Willamette, she was probably more prepared than I was, I think, to go to a four-year university.
I'm pretty sure people in general are not very prepared to go to a four-year university. Well, I mean, you get out of high school, and I'm not sure you're really ready, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. So St. Timothy's, a church that I am the pastor for now, when I was in high school, when I was a teenager, well, even before that, that was my church. That's a church that we attended, and I served as an acolyte, you know, as an altar boy. And my priest, when I was a teenager, that's the university that he went to. So I kind of felt like I had a little bit of a connection to the place, even though, you know, I hadn't visited ahead of time or anything. But I had somebody who had already blazed the way for me, so to speak. I think that makes a huge difference when you know somebody who has gone through the thing that you hope to go through,
right?
That can mentor for you, and he was able to do that.
So did you think you were going to become a priest?
No, not at all. I thought that I was going to do something other than be a fisherman. I thought I was going to climb the corporate ladder somewhere. I thought I was going to go to work for, which I did. I went to work for a corporation in Portland. After I graduated college and worked as a programmer in a building, you know, in a cubicle and typed away on a keyboard all day.
Doesn't sound very exciting.
Well, not for me, it wasn't. I mean, I'm sure that all kinds of people make good livings, you know, working in offices like that. But for me, I don't know. I guess I knew that there was something else that I wanted to do other than that. So in 1990, my wife and I came back to town and started a family and started a fishing business. So we did that for a while. I got away from St. Timothy's for a while, and I didn't get back until 1997.
So how long were you gone?
So we were gone, up in Salem, of course, for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then my wife graduated college earlier than I did, so she had a job before I did. But we got married actually before I graduated college. Mm-hmm. So we got married in 88 and I didn't graduate college till 89.
Okay.
But, so she supported me for that last year of my college. And then we lived in Portland for 2 years. So we were gone for 6 years before
it's not really that long a time to be gone.
Not really. And we, you know, certainly we came and visited on holidays and everything.
Although those are the years when you do a lot of growing up.
Well, let's hope that I did. I don't know. Still working on it, I suppose.
Me too. I still feel like I'm 16. What can you do, you know?
Well, except, you know, my legs and stuff won't cooperate.
Oh, I know. I look in the mirror and I go, 16 what, centuries?
Yeah. I know. And I went gray early too, so that didn't help.
No.
But my wife and I, though, when we came home, we started having, you know, we had our two daughters down in Crescent City where they were born. And then
at the new hospital.
At the new hospital, the 25-year-old new hospital. Mm-hmm. And then we had a slow time there in the late 90s with fishing. our quotas got, I was ground fish trawl. It was my fishery at the time with a boat called the Ginny and Jill. And, you know, things were slow. And so I had some extra time. We could catch our quota relatively quickly. And so with the extra time that I had, I was kind of looking around for a side gig. And I kind of thought that two things appealed to me. One would be to preach at folks. Not, you know, seems easy enough.
It seems easy enough, right?
And the other thing that I thought that I would like to do was be a sculptor, because my friend Manuel Lopez was somebody that I had been spending quite a bit of time with, and I envied him quite a lot. And I thought, man, if only I had the talent that he has, I'd love to have his job. And of course, I don't have that talent, but.
Well, so
if I only had the two choices, I guess preaching was what it had to be.
So when did you start moving into that whole phase?
In 2002 was okay. When I kind of got the call to ordained ministry. That's mm-hmm. when it all sort of gelled together for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite understand how that was going to work out, how I was going to be ordained. In the Episcopal Church, in our faith tradition, you have to go to seminary, and you have to have a master's in divinity is wow. the preferred training. And so anyway, I didn't see how I was going to be able to leave for 3 years while the kids were still in school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always just sort of figured that it would happen after they went to college. But they figured out a way for me to, our diocese, we have diocese, and they figured out a way for me to get training that didn't require a full 3 years of absence.
Wow.
So we did go to a seminary in Alexandria, Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. for a year, but that was to augment the other training that I'd received up in Eugene.
Excellent.
So anyway, I didn't get a master's in divinity. I got the equivalent of it.
Good.
Because
good.
The program in Eugene wasn't accredited. But anyway, it all worked out. I mean,
exactly.
They ordained me anyway. It was kind of, so that happened in 2008 on Flag Day, June 14th. Yeah. See, when people get ordained, oftentimes it's like on the feast day of a saint or something, right? So
your flag day.
I'm flag day. Everybody else gets to be ordained on like the feast day of Saint Andrew or something, and I get ordained on the flag day.
That's funny. And so, yet it seems appropriate, right?
Yeah,
day. Why not?
But it was in Azalea Park, so that was fun. And of course, Saint Timothy sits right across the street
from
Azalea Park.
Big red church. I love that.
Yeah, so it was in the band shell there, mm-hmm. And we tried to fill up the park with
great.
A couple 300 people. I don't know how many there were, but it was really a memorable day. I was very glad to have that blessing of being ordained in the same place where I graduated high school. In fact, back then in 1985, in the 80s, we had our graduation commencements in Azalea Park also.
How nice.
It wasn't the band shell, it was something else, but that's where we walked across the stage. So that had kind of a double meaning there to be able to have a couple.
Graduate and then graduate again.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah,
sort
exactly.
Sort of neat, huh? Azalea
exactly.
Park. Yeah.
I like it. So St. Timothy's is an Episcopal church.
Yeah.
So you were saying something about Anglican and as a Catholic, I understand, well, as a lapsed Catholic, I understand nothing about those Protestant religions. So,
but you might know a little bit about Martin Luther, huh?
I know that he tacked something up on doors.
Yeah, on a door, yeah.
Wittenberg. A door,
yeah.
Okay.
His 95 Theses. So
I think he was annoyed with the whole selling of indulgences.
Yeah,
I don't blame him.
Yeah, he was
annoying.
So what happened, though, was he wanted to talk about it, but nobody wanted to talk about it.
Not the Catholic Church.
Well,
the
deal is it was kind of incendiary, and he didn't want to. Well, almost kind of literally. He might have got burned at the stake, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot of people did.
So anyway, he ended up standing trial and got excommunicated, and he was a Catholic priest, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So he continued to, in his vocation as a Christian pastor, he continued in that vocation, and eventually they started the Lutheran Church in Northern Germany. And, in England, something similar was happening as far as the Reformation went. It was different, but it was kind of similar.
Okay.
So Henry VIII decided to pull away from Rome.
Oh, that's right, because of all the women in his life.
He
had a few women.
Yeah, he was married a few times.
Yes, he was.
And he might have had some other relationships.
On the side.
He might have,
yeah. Right.
So we don't think of him as our patron saint or anything.
No, good idea.
Yeah, he's not like our, Yeah, he's not the guy that we try to role model. He's just, you know, it's just part of the history of of how our church came about.
And is that then how it became the Anglican Church? Mm-hmm. Because Anglican refers to England, right?
Yep, there you go.
Okay.
So he started the Church of England and became his own pope, essentially, the leader of his...
Just declare yourself. Well, why not, right?
You know, it solidified his monarchy.
Yes.
Because in addition to becoming the leader of the church in England, he also got to seize all the properties.
Ah.
So you got all...
There you go.
So the largest landowner in England was the Catholic Church,
course,
and all of a sudden it was him instead.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of wealth in that he got to spread around in trade for loyalty and fidelity, mm-hmm. and the ability to call on other people's private armies. So he'd say, you know, I'll give you some of this land if you'll support me when I go to war.
So is Lutheran the same as Presbyterian?
No, well, the Presbyterian movement would have been a little different with John Calvin and John Knox, and would have happened in Geneva and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then ended up in Scotland. I don't really know how that part happened, but yeah. So the Presbyterian Church is similar but different. It's all part of the Reformation, though.
Okay, but St. Timothy's is Episcopalian.
Yep. So we're an Episcopal church.
Okay.
We had to come up with a new name. We couldn't be Church of England during the Revolutionary War.
That would have been really bad press.
Well, how are you going to do that? How are you going to fight against England and still call yourself the Church of England?
Not.
So we had to do something. So we came up with a name. The word Episcopal means bishop, so what we were doing is identifying us as the church where the authority to ordain is with the bishops.
Okay.
So Presbyterians, interestingly enough, the authority to ordain lays with the presbyters. Presbyters is another name for pastors.
Ah.
So if there's such a thing as a congregational church, which, you know, I guess in the East Coast they call themselves that. That's a polity though. You know, there's lots and lots of churches that organize themselves along a congregational type of, paradigm that's the congregation has the authority to ordain.
Interesting.
So those are the three major types of Christian, polity.
The other thing that I notice that's different in terms of Catholicism and Episcopalianism, is that you're married.
Well, that's kind of convenient, huh?
Yeah.
For me, anyway.
I mean, priests
One of the first things Martin Luther did when he was separated from Rome was to marry a nun.
Good for him.
Made sense.
It does make sense.
And then, you know, he could have children and whatnot. So in England, we kind of thought that sounded like a good idea.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a very good idea.
Yeah.
I don't think it's... Well, anyway.
Well, of course, one of the biggest changes that happened at the time was bringing the liturgy into the vernacular, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the worship service was all in Latin, of course, up until the Second Vatican Council in the 60s, you know, even within the Roman Catholic Church. But during the Reformation, it seemed like a good idea to change the worship language into the language of the people of the country
where
you were.
So they actually knew what they were saying.
Yeah, so that you could participate and engage in the worship service.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And then come up with hymns that people could sing as well. And so.
Although I have to admit, I loved Latin. I took 3 years of it in high school and I loved Latin.
Yeah.
I loved
There's a lot
language.
Of value in it. It's just a little inaccessible to most people.
Yes.
So that's one of the things is biblical translations. You know, it was illegal to have them in anything but Latin until the Reformation, then you could put the Bible, you could translate the Bible into the language of the people, you know.
How amazing.
The countries.
The progress is just really interesting, the whole history of that.
I don't know, but we certainly consider ourselves to be, you know, Catholic, just not with a capital C.
So yes, because Catholic means universal, right?
So we're part of the universal,
body
of Christ.
Yeah,
We see ourselves as Catholic, just not Roman Catholic.
Yeah. Good.
And we certainly see ourselves as part of the historical church.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And of course we are.
So here you are, an ordained priest and still a fisherman?
Oh, yeah. I was down at the boat this morning painting on, you know, we have some downtime right now. Our crab season's delayed until who knows when, into January sometime.
Oh, no.
And so we were able to get some of the projects done that have been on the back burner for a while. So
how is that for you, being a fisherman and a priest at the same time?
Well, I kind of think it's cool because, of course, St. Peter was both. You know, he was a bishop, the first bishop of,
and a fisher of men. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And he didn't sell his boat right away. I mean, he had that to fall back on during the early days and eventually made a transition. I probably won't be able to make that transition like St. Peter and St. Andrew did because I have, I don't know, larger expenses and our church is small and we don't have a big budget. So, so part of it, it's part of the reason why I fish is to, so I can afford my, my other vocation.
Isn't that interesting? Huh?
Yeah, so fishing kind of pays the bills.
Yeah.
So I have to make time for it, you know, when it comes getting out the paintbrush or whatever, I got to make time for it.
And I would assume that when the fish are biting, you got to go.
Well, for the crab, when crab season opens, we'll be going hard, yeah. And I'll miss at least one Sunday, and we'll have somebody fill in for me. Mm-hmm. But usually I don't miss two. Usually, you know, crab fishery is a derby. So after the first couple of weeks, things have slowed down to the point where I kind of like try to plan ahead so that we get Sundays off. And my crewmen appreciate it.
Do you go out for days at a time then?
Well, at the beginning of the crab season, yeah, we'll spend the night.
Ugh.
Yeah. Now tuna fishing, in the summer we tuna fish, and that'll be up to 12 days. But I stay home for that one, and my dad takes the boat.
So tuna fishing is way out there, right?
It is, yeah. You can go 100 miles offshore and maybe a couple hundred miles to the north, end up off of Washington State, 100 miles offshore. It's a long-ranging.
So how long does it take you to go 100 miles offshore?
Well,
I mean, days?
Well, no, so 7 knots. And when I talk about 100 miles, I mean nautical miles.
Okay, I don't know.
So whatever 100 divided by 7 is.
Oh, yeah,
apparently there's
miles are not miles.
No, they're nautical miles.
Okay.
So there's 6,078 feet or something like that. So a nautical mile is, I don't know, it's considerably further than a land mile.
Wow.
And so we convert everything into that. There's all sorts of good reasons for that, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, seems confusing to me, but
yeah,
you know,
except a degree of latitude is 60 nautical miles. So that makes sense.
Okay.
So it's kind of, yeah.
Okay. So interesting.
So what's 100 divided by 7, Candace?
Oh, please. Seriously? Math was not my forte.
You know, in order to go to the seminary that I went to, I had to take the GRE, you know, that whatever that stands for.
Yes.
What does that stand for?
Yeah, I do.
It's an entrance exam for graduate schools. Well, they told me that my math score wouldn't count. They were more interested in whether or not I could speak in complete sentences.
I like that. Yeah. And that's really what's important because you can always get a calculator.
Yeah, it turns out at seminary there wasn't any math classes.
Yeah, sounds perfect to me.
Yeah, and you know, when Jesus does math, somehow or another he takes 7 loaves or whatever. And
just multiplies them.
Yeah.
So exactly. He doesn't care.
It's not according to a formula or anything.
Exactly. Just keep multiplying over there.
Yeah.
You were also responsible for the health clinic that got started,
weren't
you?
Yeah, so we had a free health clinic for 4 years at St. Timothy's from 2010 to 2014. And we had all kinds of very dedicated, very good volunteers that were part of that. I think over the course of that 4 years, we had maybe as many as 100 different people who had been involved volunteering.
Wow.
And on average, it was probably 20 people a week.
Wow.
And we would treat anywhere from 15 to 25 patients. And that's only on a Tuesday afternoon from 1 o'clock until 5. And we had some really good doctors and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and registered nurses that devoted a tremendous amount of time and effort into our...
And the point of that was to bring healthcare to people who could not afford it.
Yeah, we had 1,500 unique patients that used that were not transitory, that Brookings is their town. Brookings is where they live. And then we had another 300 patients that were passing through. So over the course of that 4 years, 1,500 people of working age, we didn't treat children. Children had other means at their disposal. Mm-hmm. So working age people... because if you're over 65, you know, you hit the lottery and you get at the time.
Exactly.
I mean, now, fortunately, we have healthcare available for people. But at the time, you kind of had to wait till you turned 65 in order to be able to get Medicare. Otherwise, if you didn't have health insurance through your workplace, you were just stuck.
Yeah, really stuck. Because the costs are just prohibitory.
Yeah. We had a lot of people with chronic conditions too, mm-hmm. with diabetes or high blood pressure, mm-hmm. or, you know, respiratory issues, COPD type stuff. Mm-hmm. So there was all kinds of people that needed long-term care. And one of our volunteers, a woman named Judy, she made sure to, she had a way to contact various different pharmaceutical companies to get people's prescriptions for free.
Oh, that's nice.
So it was, I don't remember what we called that now, but it was part of one of our programs, mm-hmm. was to provide people with long-term prescription assistance.
Excellent.
And then if it was something relatively small, we paid for it out of the money that we had raised. Hmm. We were able to get some grants, and we had a fundraiser that was a tuna feed, which was pretty fun.
Yes.
And we did the tuna feed at the Presbyterian Church at the other end of First Street.
Okay.
So we had all sorts of, we were teamed up and continue to be teamed up with lots of different groups. We're not an island unto ourselves. We can't do the things that we do without all kinds of different people being part of, you know, our outreach.
So tell me why the clinic went away.
Well, in 2014, Obamacare came into being. And so the Oregon Health Plan was expanded so that people that, you know, were living in poverty actually had access to healthcare finally. So we were glad. We celebrated the fact that
absolutely, what a blessing
that people could receive healthcare that was far better than what we could provide, mm-hmm. on an ongoing basis. Because mm-hmm. there we are, you know, open 4 hours a week.
Right.
If somebody gets sick on a Wednesday, they're gonna have to wait all the way till next Tuesday. That's not gonna work.
Right.
And you know, I've had people tell me, well, they could just go to the emergency room. What's the big deal? Go to the emergency room. Nobody can get turned away. Well, the problem is, of course, is that it costs about 10 times more to go to the emergency room to provide, you know, these basic type of healthcare.
And it costs us. That's the thing that seems to escape
people. Somebody
pays. Somebody pays.
Somebody pays, Candace. That's not, you know, it's not like those, you know, those doctors didn't just donate their time because the person couldn't pay.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it takes the form of higher insurance rates.
That's right.
And higher costs for everyone.
That's right.
So, and obviously.
And they are obviously not going to be admitted into the hospital if they need, you know, they get emergency.
If you ran out of insulin.
Right.
If you ran out of insulin and you got to go to the emergency room, well, you might have to if you waited too long and you're going into a diabetic coma.
Right.
That's worst case scenario. See, the quality of life is so much better for people if they get preventative medicine rather than have to wait until they're in a crisis.
And you know, it seems like that's a no-brainer, but I don't know. People don't get it.
Well, you know, the thing, the need was so high and continues to be high, of course, mm-hmm. for people to have access to healthcare. But think about 1,500 people in our community, because if you look at our zip code 97415, you got about 14,000 people that live in our zip code. And we certainly did treat people that came from Gold Beach and the mm-hmm. rest of the county. Mm-hmm. And people even came all the way as far away as Medford and stuff, and up from Crescent City. But if you look at the 14,000 people, you got a couple thousand of those are children under the age of 18. Mm-hmm. So now out of the 12,000 people that you have left, could be that half of them are over the age of 65 or of retirement age.
Right.
So now you're looking at 6,000 people mm-hmm. that are of working age. And we saw 1,500 out of the, that's one in four of the working age folks?
Right.
I mean, it almost seems inconceivable.
Yes.
Until you realize that a lot of the people that you see in retail or in service industry type jobs, they're not getting health insurance. You know, not everybody's working at the prison getting, you know,
that's
really
right.
good health insurance.
That's right.
There's all kinds of, we have a big part of our economy is service-based. So you got all kinds of folks that are working 20 hours a week maybe because, mm-hmm. you know, that's what's available to them. Mm-hmm. So they have to hold down two jobs at 20 hours a week and they have to work that schedule out between the two jobs. And
they have kids,
that just makes it more complicated,
exactly,
doesn't it?
Exactly.
So we've had, there's all sorts of people. We have to keep our files for like 5 or 10 years or mm-hmm. whatever. So our files are still locked away in our nurse's station.
Right.
And it's 3 file cabinets.
Wow.
Because, you know, we were trying to transition to electronic medical records, but it made more sense for us to keep things on paper.
Right.
And we never did make the transition because we.
It's always good to have a paper trail.
So we still have those records here. One of these days, you know, when the time comes, when our time is up, we'll be able to hire. There'll be a company that'll come in. Mm-hmm. You know, they have these mobile paper shredder companies.
Yes.
So that'll actually be kind of. We'll be able to free up some space in our basement when we get the chance to finally shred those. But it was a lot. We saw a lot of people.
Well, you did a lot of good, obviously. You did a lot of good.
You know, there was more than one person said that we saved their lives. Mm. And that's kind of cool.
I think it's significant.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with the whole homelessness issue?
Well, you know, our church has always been interested in what we can do for people who are struggling. Mm-hmm. I kind of think that's a big part of what Christianity is based on. I think that Jesus' earthly ministry was a lot about feeding people, healing people, and preaching and teaching. But a big part of what Jesus did involved healing and feeding.
Absolutely.
And certainly the people who needed to be healed and fed were the people who were struggling and couldn't afford to see a doctor, couldn't afford to make ends meet to be able to feed themselves necessarily. So I think that Jesus' ministry was really involved with people who were peasants, people who were struggling, people who were the least of these. You know, it's
yep.
that passage that comes out of Matthew chapter 25.
Yep. Whatsoever you shall do. Yeah.
Unto the least of these you've done unto me. So
yeah.
we take that pretty seriously. It's not like we have that Bible verse written above the doorway when we go inside, but it's certainly one of the things that guides us.
And I think that, you know, you don't have to have that written above the doorway when it's written in your heart.
You know, there's something in the Bible about that too.
Hmm. Yeah.
About, you know, God's law being written on our hearts.
Well, that's where it counts, isn't it? I mean, you know, I get so tired of hearing people talk. And then you look to see what they're doing in their lives, and they're not walking the talk.
Well, I always feel like there's more that I could be doing, but you know, the fact is that if we're going to be Christ-like, if we're going to emulate Jesus, then we're going to have to get in the mix. We're going to have to get out into the highways and byways where the people are, and interact with them, and figure out ways to improve their situations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I don't know. For us, that's the way that we understand our faith and our Christianity. I'm talking about the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't come up with this on my own. I was formed by this congregation. Our former priest,
nice.
You know, the priest that was the head of the church before mm-hmm. my own self was a man named Bill Smith, Father Bill Smith. And so him and the congregation were the ones that led me to an understanding of Christ that I think is life-giving.
Nice.
And not just for me.
Right.
But for the people that we minister to.
Exactly. And that's the point, isn't it?
It is.
Yes.
To me, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, the thing is, too, is that we're not trying to proselytize anybody or bring them into our way of thinking. What we want to do is improve their situation so that they can find their own spirituality, whatever that might be. Because, and you know this, when people are struggling just day to day trying to figure out how they're going to be able to survive, where they're going to, and it literally is survival. Where are they going to sleep tonight? They don't know. Where are they going to, if they're living in their car, where are they going to park it tonight? Where are they going to get their next meal? How are they going to get gas for their car if they are living in their car? Where are they going to get, a lot of people have pets, you know, they have dogs or cats or whatever, and they give them companionship. They're part of their family.
Yes.
Well, where are they going to get their dog food? And mm-hmm. how are they going to, so that struggle, you're not going to be thinking along. You know, we're fortunate that we have all of our needs met, that we can think on philosophical and spiritual lines. When you're really just living minute to minute, your next thought isn't going to be, you know, some, you know, deeply theological.
Well, it can't be. You don't have room in your brain for it.
No, but see,
don't.
If you can be stabilized, if you can
yes.
get a place to live, if you can get stability mm-hmm. in your life, then you can start moving in those directions. So we have no intention of trying to convert somebody to some way of thinking. Our goal is to get them so that they'll eventually be able to get to that point.
So let's talk about what homelessness looks like in Curry County or Brookings specifically. Mm-hmm. What do you see?
So a lot of the people that we minister to live on the ground. You know, they sleep at night on the ground. They maybe they have a tent where they found a place where they can get in deep into the bushes and they can have a tent that they don't have to worry about it, you know, that it'll get pilfered while they're away during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Other people roll up in a tarp. Maybe they're down on a beach somewhere in a driftwood pile and they're rolled up in a tarp. The people that the people that have a car to live in are actually ahead of the game
mm-hmm.
because they're more mobile. They can get to various different places more easily. but also they have a safe place where they can store their things. They can lock the door to their car when they leave to go do something else. So the people who are living in a tent or, you know, are living, you know, behind a tree somewhere, it's very hard for them to trust that when they come back, that their camp will still be there. So, and then they have all sorts of other obstacles too. How do you prepare your meals? How do you cook them? I mean, certainly during the fire, nobody wanted to start, you know, a campfire.
No,
I mean, it was illegal, but nobody wanted to take a chance on that anyway.
That's right.
And, so you have to work, you know, you have to have prepared meals or, you know, eat stuff cold out of a can or whatever. It's, that's part of the reason why, Roderick Gilbert and Ernie Madden started the Community Kitchens program. And I guess that was in 2009, although it could have been 2008. I lose track of what year it was.
I do too. But, I know. The years are all going together now.
And St. Timothy's, our Tuesday soup kitchen wasn't the first one. The first one was actually the Monday community kitchen that's at the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Mm-hmm. So that was the one that was started first. And once that got up and running after 2 or 3 months, then we finally got our chance to open too. Mm-hmm. I was anxious to begin, but Ernie and Roger wanted to get that one started before they started ours.
It was a great thing, though. I remember working in the community garden at St. Tim's, and we'd make sure that we harvested stuff on Tuesdays and got it to you so that you could use it in the lunches.
Yeah, we a few years ago, we acquired some a flag lot next to the church, and we've cultivated that into a community garden, and a lot of that food goes into the community kitchens. The other food goes into the people who helped grow it, because the people who have a stake in this, we want to make sure they benefit too.
Absolutely.
So it gets, I don't know how evenly divided. I mean, it depends on who, you know, different people have different needs or different abilities to prepare the food.
So what do you see in terms of the population of homelessness? I mean, are we talking mostly transients? Are we talking mostly families? Are we talking a division? And isn't there couch surfing that's being done by kids? I mean, what does it look like?
I suppose there is. We don't see a lot of the children. I mean, in the summer we see a few, but what we see mostly are the people who don't have access to like a shower, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, when you live in your car, where are you going to take a shower? Or when you live in the woods, where are you going to take a shower? So on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, when we have our regular office hours, we make our shower in one of the bathrooms, we discovered there's a shower.
Hmm.
And we decided that we would make that available to the people who don't have access to a shower.
That's wonderful.
So we probably have a dozen folks on a day like today, a Friday. We're recording this on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And there's maybe 12, 15 people use the shower at St. Timothy's on a Friday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're
seeing— Boy, the difference in being able to get clean— That would make a big difference.
And then to be able to get your clothes clean also, because we have an arrangement with one of the laundromats so that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
That happens on Tuesdays also. And then, and not only that, we have some clean clothes that people can, because my thought there is that if your clothes are yucky, do you want to put those back on again after your shower?
Yeah, not
so
too much.
So we have some clean clothes that are available also, but then, and then one thing too that we had to figure out is how do we wash all those towels?
So we have
some volunteers that take the towels after the shower days and take them home and wash them and bring them back. And then we also use the laundromat to wash the towels also after the showers. But mostly, and you talk about, are people just passing through? Some people are passing through. That's certainly the case. And what proportion, you know, whether that's half or a third of the people that we minister to, whether they're passing through, it's, I don't know. Sometimes people will linger for a while when they, as they're traveling, and that certainly happens. There's not a lot of houses available for rent or apartments available for rent, so a lot of people keep on going just because, where, you know, how are they going to be able to rent a place when there's none available? But a large number of people that we minister to have lived here for 20 years, 15 years, maybe 5, you know. But they live here. Mm-hmm. This is their home.
Mm-hmm.
A large number of the people that we minister to, this is their home.
And so, what happened? You know, how did they
go from a high school student that was, you know, graduated high school and ended up now they live in the outer doors?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a couple of ways that happens. Oftentimes, people come out of broken families,
mm-hmm.
and so they didn't really have the support, perhaps. Mm-hmm. One guy that I know, his family moved away and he stayed here because he considered this his home. Mm. And he had gone to high school here. And so he stayed in the community. And eventually he, schizophrenia doesn't present right away. People mm-hmm. who are schizophrenic, it's not something you notice when they're children. It's more like the symptoms of it gradually become more apparent.
It's usually an elder, teenager, young 20s kind of presentation, I think.
I kind of have in my own mind, what I think is that when you're young, you maybe have enough energy to kind of overcome it or mm-hmm. deal with it a little bit more. Once you get to be in your later 20s, you don't quite have the ability to mask it any longer. Mm-hmm. You don't quite have, mm-hmm. it sort of wears on a person. So, there's a mental illness portion mm-hmm. of homelessness. And of course, there's a substance abuse portion of homelessness mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. But there's also people who have had a tragedy in their lives of some sort. You know, one guy that I know, he got hit by a car. You know, he's in an intersection and he got hit by a car and he went from being able to work to not being able to work.
Right.
And eventually his home, went away and eventually he ended up, living in the woods. And my wife was in the hospital a year ago. And one of the things that they say is that for every day you're in the hospital, it takes 7 days after your, 7 days to recuperate for every day that you've been in the hospital.
Wow.
And that was our experience because she was in the hospital for a month and it's about 7 months later before she was really back to where she had been before she had gotten ill.
Right.
And so there's a ratio here, it doesn't take a long time to get really down in a deep, dark hole, but it takes a really long time to get back out. And if the ratio is 7-1 or whatever, then if somebody's been homeless for 5 years, it's going to take 35 years to get out. I mean, I don't know.
God, but it's not. If that's the case.
Well, I don't know.
Wow.
All I know is that it's a really mm-hmm. hard thing to get out of the deep, dark hole that people get, that they fall into.
Plus which it's a whole emotional, psychological thing. You get into that deep, dark hole. Yeah. It's,
And think about, so your self-worth is,
bottomed out.
Way down in the toilet.
Absolutely.
Sure. So then how do you, how do people manage to overcome? Well, one of the ways I think is for them to have a community that they can be involved in, a sense of community, mm-hmm. a group of friends, a group of people that can support them emotionally and look after them when they get sick and stuff like that. So we try to create that kind of community for the people who are struggling. And, I'm fortunate enough to be part of that community for the people who are struggling.
Yeah, I would think that would be a huge factor in somebody being able to get out of that deep, dark hole. I mean, it seems like the three things that really contribute to this community having a lot of homelessness is the fact that the house prices are through the ceiling. There's no... there's no real industry here, so
well, fishing industry. Come on,
yes,
now.
Right. If you've got a boat, or you can be on a boat.
Yeah, well, it is physically demanding.
It is very. And otherwise, you're kind of locked into service jobs that are not paying really well.
Yeah. So at $10 an hour, how are you going to afford $800 a month rent?
Exactly.
Especially when you're only working 20 hours a week.
Exactly.
And then what if you have kids and you're trying to provide them during the same thing?
That's right.
Yeah,
and we have no real good mental health facilities here.
Yeah,
I mean that's a problem.
I have hope. I have hope. Currently, I don't think we have a psychiatrist in Curry County, but I have hope that that'll change. And I know some of the people who work for the Curry Community Health as therapists, as counselors, mm-hmm. and they are very dedicated people mm-hmm. that do a good job. But the caseload is so big.
Sure,
there's such a high need. And then a lot of people won't go receive mental health services because of the stigma that society has put on it.
Exactly.
So even the people, even if we did have, even if all the people who are looking to have the needs met for mental health were getting it met, there still are going to be a whole bunch of people that are going to be reluctant to go and receive services.
Which is just crazy. I mean, I've suffered with depression for 20 some years. And if I didn't have my medication every day, I would be below the line. That's just the way it would be.
But I wonder though, Candace, because when you very first started taking medication, you know, to treat your, was there a stigma though? I mean,
No, I didn't want to take it. And my therapist finally said to me, you will either start medication or I'm going to hospitalize you.
So there's a reluctancy that you
there
had.
Was.
Even you had
absolutely.
That reluctance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So imagine how it is for people who don't know how they'll be able to afford it.
I know. Oh, yeah, I know.
So it just makes it even more difficult.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's rough because if you already have psychological problems or you're depressed or whatever, that not being able to get the kind of help you need only pushes you farther down.
There you go.
Yeah, it's brutal. It's
yeah,
just
and then
brutal.
imagine if you do get prescribed medication that is beneficial. And then imagine you don't have a medicine cabinet to keep your medicine in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're living in your car, it's just going to, how are you going to stay on a schedule and stuff with your medication? There's so many other things to worry about that the medication could easily be forgotten
or
could fall by the wayside.
Exactly. So do you see the issues becoming more pronounced during the holidays? I would think that, you know, given what the holidays generally mean about family and friends and decorating your home and all that stuff, that it would be worse.
Well, I think that probably is part of that depression thing like you're mm-hmm. talking about. Certainly you're going to feel worse because we're going to have a meal on the set. See, because this Christmas this year is going to be on a Monday. So Christmas Eve is on a Sunday. And so we're going to have a Christmas meal on the Saturday on the 23rd.
Great.
And, part of our hope behind that is that people will be able to come and feel a little festive, even though they might be struggling, that they can at least come and join in with a bunch of other folks who are in the same situation. So, do I see more need? I don't see more need during the holidays because the need is always the same, really. But what I do see where people are more aware of it as they're thinking about, you know, the benefits that they have, you know, like my daughters are going to come and visit, and my one daughter lives in New York City and the other daughter lives up near Salem. But the idea that when I realize how blessed I am that I get to have my daughters come and visit and we get to have a Christmas tree and everything and decorate the house, it does make me realize that, boy, what about the other people? It does make me think about the people that don't have those things that we take for granted. So one good thing that happens during the holidays is sometimes our donations go up mm-hmm. and sometimes we will try to rally around families that where maybe they're not homeless, but it's a family where their children won't be able to have a Merry Christmas unless they get some help.
And how do you do that? Do you identify a family in your congregation or?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
You know, sometimes it's, mostly a lot of our outreach is exactly that. We reach mm-hmm. out of our own selves, mm-hmm. out of our own church, out of our own safety net into the lives of people who are outside, our congregation.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's part of the advantage. You know, you talked about my ties into the community because I've been here for a little while. Well, 50 years, I suppose. If you
that's a little
that
while, yes.
But
how time flies.
So what happens is I get to, I got all kinds of different people that I know that know mm-hmm. that in turn know other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of ask somebody if they know somebody mm-hmm. and turns out they do. We had a Christmas tree that somebody didn't, I don't know how it happened, but we ended up with this Christmas tree. And we already have one for the congregation, you know, for the church itself.
Right.
And so I asked my one friend that I've known since we were in the fifth grade. And I said, hey, you know anybody that, a family that needs a Christmas tree? And he says, yeah. And he came up with two or three ideas. And finally, one of the people that he knew ended up with that Christmas tree.
How nice.
And the cool part is that he delivered it so I didn't have to.
Oh, that's good.
So that made it all the
money. Yeah, that's right.
That part worked.
You'd say, let somebody else do the work.
Yeah. Well, you got to share in that too.
Yeah.
So, that's one example. There's other examples of, I have another friend that I went to high school with. We were on the wrestling team together, in fact, and he had been a commercial fisherman from a commercial fishing family when he was a child. And he said, and he lives somewhere else now, but he sent me some money and said, I want you to find a fishing family that is not going to get a Christmas. And you can well imagine a whole bunch of us aren't going to get a Christmas this year because we're not going to start crabbing until after Christmas.
And I thought crabbing was supposed to start on the 15th of December.
Oh, well, the 1st of December. The 1st.
No, but then I thought I just saw something the other day that said the 15th of December, but now it's been pushed back.
Yeah, it has to do with the crabs haven't filled out all the way.
Yeah.
Since the last molt, they haven't filled their meat back in again. So
That means that all you guys that were counting on that before Christmas.
Well, see, in Charleston, so Coos Bay and Newport, they both have really their crabs are ready to harvest. And if you go up into Washington State, their crab are ready to harvest too. The place that's allowed to harvest. There's a whole other world that happens up in Washington State with the native fisheries and stuff. But anyway, it turned out though that Garibaldi and Astoria, their crab haven't filled out all the way yet. So because of that, the northern part of the state is going to have to delay until after Christmas. But there was talk before we knew that, that we were hoping that the northern part of the state would be able to open on the 15th. So, and then, you know, what's good about that is Brookings boats, if they need to, can go up to Coos Bay and put in their season up there.
Okay.
But since it didn't open, they have to wait just like they're, you know, there is no plan.
Well, and I think that the fire must have had a tremendous impact on people here too. I mean, not some people actually did lose their home, and that's, you know, tragic.
There are plenty of homeless people though that were living in the woods that was on national forest land. Those people got displaced.
So their homes are gone too.
Well, they are, but they didn't advertise it or tell anybody.
Right,
I mean,
what
are they supposed to say? I was living in the national forest and now I can't anymore. I mean, you don't go on the nightly news and tell them that or whatever. You know, when KOBI comes to town, you don't get in front of the camera. Although one friend of mine did talk about how he had been displaced.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, people need to know, you know, that the more we don't talk about it, the more it disappears.
Well, there you go.
And that's not a good thing. We need to be aware.
In a way, but we do want it to disappear.
I know.
We do want homelessness to disappear.
I know.
One of the things that I tell people is that we want our homeless population in Brookings Harbor to be the cleanest, politest, able to, you know, blend into the point where you wouldn't know that they were homeless.
Right.
We want our homeless people to not look homeless.
Yeah.
So in a way, you're right. We do want it to disappear.
Yes.
And and certainly if you are a person who is homeless, you don't want to look different. You want to be able to blend in.
Of course.
You want to be able to, you want to be able to avoid the stigma.
Of course.
Part of our goal is to empower people to be able to overcome that stigma and not be subject to it.
So what can people do who are interested in, you know, trying to help make the holidays a happier time for homeless people? What can we do?
Well, you know, and you know, you're thinking about the holidays and stuff. I think more long-term, of course.
Of course.
But one of the things certainly is to volunteer in one of the community kitchens, you know. It's 7 days a week now because we have... We had a hard time filling in, getting Sunday figured out, but we were able to do that through a sack lunch program through St. Timothy's. But the other churches, you know, the Presbyterian and the Lutheran and Star of the Sea, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Seventh-day Adventists, you know, to donate food to their program if you have extra food for whatever reason, it's... You know, you show up on the day where they are. There's schedules. I don't know if the schedules are all over the place anymore, but, you know, Wednesday is Star of the Sea, and Tuesday is St. Timothy's, and Thursday is the Presbyterian Church, and Friday today is Trinity Lutheran, and then Saturday we have the women that... There's a group of people that are involved in the Saturday feeding thing that it's kind of separate from St. Timothy's. They used to be over at Azalea Middle School, and now they're, you know, using our facility because it makes sense.
Right.
But you know how that works. People at the middle school, there's a rule that you can't smoke, you know, no tobacco products. Well, a lot of the people that we minister to have tobacco addictions.
Yeah.
And so we have designated smoking areas at St. Timothy's. Mm-hmm. We don't condemn people for smoking. So it makes sense for people to be able to come and eat there where there isn't that rule than there is at the middle school. So anyway, that made sense. So we welcome them over for the Saturday. And so
if somebody wanted to get in touch with you to donate something or get involved in some way, how would they do that?
Well, the church phone number is 3314, right? Pretty sure it's 3314.
3314?
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure there are other numbers there.
Nine. You dial 9. Back in the day, we dialed 9.
So I bet it's 541. 469.
Yeah.
469.
3314.
Thank you.
See, I always get confused because the Lutheran Church has a similar number.
Ah, that is a
But if you called them, it wouldn't be all bad either. You could talk to Pastor Pastor Matt over there, and he could certainly use some donations also when it comes to food for their Friday soup.
And I would think that any kind of donations would be helpful to help people through.
Yeah, the clothing part, you know, the clothes, towels, because we do, you know, our towels wear out. Mm-hmm. We have to replace our towel inventory once in a while. Or sometimes people need to take a towel with them because they need a towel and they don't have one.
Right.
If somebody needs something, we don't, you know, we don't tell them no. We try to figure out a way to make it happen.
So are there specific clothing items?
Well, sleeping bags. Just today, I had a guy ask me. So before I went down and started painting the boat, I went into the church office for a little while, and a guy asked me for a sleeping bag. And I didn't have a sleeping bag, but I did have a blanket.
Good.
We try to make sure nobody goes away empty-handed.
Right.
You know, to the best of our ability.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So anyway, sleeping bags are always popular. Warm jackets this time of year, you know, waterproof type stuff.
Right.
Or say, you know, rain pants. The we call them bibs out on the boat. You know, the ones that they're like coveralls.
Right.
And
socks, warm socks.
Well, socks. That's an interesting thing because we got a great big huge donation from a sock manufacturing company called Bombas. A few months ago.
Wow.
And they donated, it was dozens and dozens, something like 544 pairs.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, it was a dozen times four. So there with that math thing again.
Yeah.
So whatever 144 times four would be.
Wow.
So we're still able to give some of those away. And then we've had other donations of socks in addition to those. So if somebody doesn't want black wool socks. We have other socks also available.
That's great.
You know, underwear is a tough one because nobody ever wants to get used.
No.
Recycled underwear.
No.
So fresh, clean underwear is important.
Absolutely.
And then there's other things that are important too, you know, hygiene type stuff.
Yep.
And
toothbrush would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, we were talking earlier about what the face of the homeless population is. And so certainly a lot of men, right? But couples too. Married couples that maybe their kids are currently being raised by a grandparent.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trying to reestablish themselves.
Right.
And but here's the thing that I've noticed. If they have a car to live in, they do have a distinct advantage over the people that don't have a car. It's easier for them to get a job. It's easier for them to be employed, and it's easier for them to get housed.
Yeah.
So sometimes people donate cars to me, and I find homes for them.
Okay.
And especially minivans are really way cool because you can kind of live in a minivan and still be discreet, right?
All right. I think we are just about out of time, which makes me very sad.
That was a whole 59 minutes already.
Isn't that amazing? I know. It is truly amazing.
I hope your listeners feel the same way.
Father Bernie, I would really love to have you come back because I would like to have you talk about some of your plans for the future because I know you have some.
That's right.
So thank you very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it and have a very Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you for having me, Candace.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening. This is Our Community. I'm Candace Michelle. Happy holidays.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.